May it please the court and good afternoon. My name is LeVar Taylor, and I represent and appearing on behalf of the appellants Jeff and Tamara Yap. The key issue in the present case is, when did the Yap's business, Real Food, Real Life, start for income tax purposes? The Yap's argued below and argued on this appeal that the business started for income tax purposes at the beginning of 2009. The tax court below said it did not start prior to 2011, and the tax court got it wrong. The first issue I'd like to discuss is the standard of review. The Jackson case in the 10th Circuit, which specifically dealt with a startup cost situation, held that this issue is a mixed question of law and fact. When you have a situation where the facts before the trial court are not really in dispute, and the trial court drew inferences from the evidence. In this, and this circuit's precedent, which is the Shea Holmes case, didn't involve this startup cost situation, but it also affirms the fact that this is a situation where that there is a mixed question of law fact reviewed de novo. If you review the tax court's opinion, pages 4 through 6 and 14 through 15, the tax court did not say, oh, I don't believe any of the evidence in front of me. They did not say, I don't believe the testimony of the taxpayers. The tax court said, I've looked at the evidence, and in my view, this evidence just is not sufficient to prove that the taxpayers started their business prior to 2011.
Well, the tax court pointed to a variety of facts that they thought were significant. They pointed to the February 2011 launch party. They pointed to the first product delivery didn't arrive, in their view, until late 2010 in December. They looked at the facts and found that the startup phase continued through 2010. I understand that your client's view is that no, there's plenty of evidence that we were actually commenced before then, but the tax court felt that the evidence supported a different conclusion. Regardless of the standard of review, why is that reversible?
It's reversible because of the other evidence not mentioned by the tax court in its opinion that was in the record that was undisputed. So, for example, okay, the Schedule Cs on the 2009 and the 2010 tax returns, there were Schedule Cs. That's the reporting vehicle for the reporting the income and expenses from this business. On the Schedule C for 2009, there was a small amount of gross receipts. It's very small, but still there. There was a product sale. On 2010, Schedule C, there was about 3,000 or 4,000 of gross receipts. There were product sales. So you have that evidence in the record. There was other evidence in the record.
But counsel, is your argument that evidence compels a finding in your client's favor, or is it your argument that the fact that the tax court didn't mention that evidence in their opinion shows that they erred?
Well, I don't necessarily view as what Your Honor said as being mutually exclusive. That evidence, in addition to the other evidence that I'll mention, does, I think, compel as a matter of law the conclusion that the taxpayers were, quote, in business in 2009. And for that reason, the tax court did err. So this is not a situation where the first activity started in 2009. There's evidence in the record, for example, where the Tamara Yap sent an email saying, oh, I'm about ready to finalize the formula for the product. This is in 2008, before the business started in the minds of the taxpayers. So there's activity before 2008. This is not a situation where all of a sudden, oh, 2009, we're going to start a business. The contract with AGM started effective January 1st. Product shipments started in early 2009 and continued through 2009 and 2010. If you go look at the summary of what was shipped annually during 2009 and 2010, Exhibit 213J says that during 2009, over 1,500 bottles of liquid from AGM were shipped, and over 920 containers of powder from AGM were shipped during 2009. During 2010, the apps received over 7,400 bottles of liquid from AGM and over 3,700 containers of powders. You don't receive those unless you're trying to sell something. You don't have gross receipts unless you're trying to sell something. And Cabin Taxi, which is the Seventh Circuit case that reversed the tax court's finding that there was no trade or business, explicitly holds you don't need gross receipts to be in business.
What about the trademark applications? Because as the tax court noted, you were telling the PTO in 2009 and 2010 that you were engaged in product or service research and development, and only in January 2011 did you say that you were actually engaged in commerce. So can you address that?
The IP attorney testified at trial that, in his view, what was placed before the trademark authorities had no bearing on that. And the reason for that is you can be doing more than one thing at once, okay? In other words, we don't dispute that there was experimentation. There was experimentation with the labels. The record clearly shows that. But the law, the tax law, not the IP law, the tax law says if you have product or you have the ability to provide product, because Cabin Taxi, there was no inventory because it was some big train thing that you couldn't put on a shelf or even have in a showroom. If you have the ability to sell and the willingness to sell and you make efforts to promote your product, that's all that's required. You don't need a trademark. You can have something that you don't necessarily place in commerce because you haven't finalized it. But the tax law is not in peri materia with the trademark law.
Well, sure, but it's, isn't it at least some evidence that supports the conclusion that you weren't really engaged in selling things in 2009 and 2010? And to add to that, isn't that also supported by the evidence that the payment gateway, the web hosting, the business license and liability insurance, all started around the same time in early 2011.
The record's there as far as those items are concerned. But the clients, the apps, were receiving product and they were trying to sell it. You can try to sell a product without insurance. You can try to sell a product without a trademark. You can try to sell a product without a business license. I have to confess, when I left the government and went to private practice, it took me a year to discover I needed a business license. That's not outcome determinative. What matters?
Oh, it's not outcome determinative, but the question is, are these startup expenses or did the business operation actually commence? And it may well be, as you say, that IP law doesn't govern tax law, but Judge Miller was accurately reporting what was on the application, the words that were used, right?
There's no question the words were on the application. Yes, no dispute.
And to me, that does support the commissioner's view and the tax court's finding that that the business operation had not actually commenced until 2011. It doesn't mean that there wasn't some evidence the other way, but it just doesn't seem to me that the evidence that you've suggested compels, under the tax law as a matter of law, a find the business commenced earlier than when the commissioner argued and the tax court found.
Well, I understand Your Honor's position. However, I would respectfully submit that the case law says that if you can sell, you have the ability to sell. There's no legal restriction to sell, and there's no practical restriction to sell, and you are trying to sell. That's all that's required. And the record is replete with efforts by the apps, efforts to sell, efforts to promote the product during 2009 and 2010. And they got money in 2009 and 2010. And again, you don't need a trademark. You don't need, you don't need insurance, and you don't need a promotional event with Justin Timberlake either. That's, you know, premised on a promotion of a product that's completely different from what they were promoting to autistic children. Autistic children don't drink, I hope, alcoholic beverages with dietary supplements. Let me briefly then turn to the penalty. This is a case where the outcome is reasonably debatable. And under this circuit's authority, that means there should be no penalty, even if the court, this court rules against the apps on the issue of the startup costs. You can see from the briefs that the cases, I use the word schizophrenic. You have some cases that say you can be in business before you have a rental property ready to rent, before you're able to lease it out. You have case law that says authors who have not published a book, have a trader business before they've even gotten the contract. They're writing their book. They are in a trader business. That is clearly, and in this circuit, there is no case law whatsoever. And again, the authorities say, if it's reasonably debatable, there should be no penalty.
But isn't the debate here really, I mean, it seems like the disagreement is not really over the legal standard, which is, you know, when did you start selling? But just a factual question of, you know, at what date did that occur? And so if we think that the facts, you know, support the commissioner's conclusion, then what really is the reasonably debatable issue here?
Well, again, if you're saying as a legal matter, I'll come back to answer your question in a minute, but there's a legal component to this and a factual component to this. And our legal argument is the IP doesn't matter. The Timberlake party doesn't matter. What matters is we had a contract. We had the ability to import product. We had, and there was an effort to import product. There was no practical or no law in place that prohibited my clients from going out and selling. And they went out and they promoted. They talked to Whole Foods. They went around and talked to doctors. And our argument is that's sufficient. There's no case law out there that deals with that fact pattern. None. And that's why there's a reasonable basis. So,
I mean, what's your response to the tax court's statement that this couldn't be reasonable because the returns were filled with a variety of errors, and the testimony at trial was that these were approved without fully reviewing them and without providing the CPA complete information?
We're not arguing here that the issue that was decided, you know, specifically decided by the tax court. The tax court said you can't rely on the CPA to get out of the penalty. That's not our argument here. Our argument is a legal one. We don't need to argue that they relied on it. It's a matter of if this is a reasonably debatable issue, even if we lose, there should be no penalty. It's a pure legal issue. So that. We're not here to argue about whether they reasonably relied on the CPA. We're just not. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Moriarty, whenever you're ready. If you've started talking, you're still muted.
Oh.
We can hear you now.
Great. May it please the court, I'm Regina Moriarty, and I represent the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. As your honors have been discussing, the issue with regard to the Real Food for Real Life is at what point in time did that business begin to operate? And the law is very clear that you cannot get a deduction under 162 until the time that the business has begun to function as a going concern and performed those activities for which it was organized. And as you have just been discussing, the tax court here looked to the fact that they didn't have liability insurance or a business license until 2011. They didn't pay commission payments until 2011 to Next Music for the use of their platform for their sales. They didn't begin to use their trademark. And my opposing counsel brought up the inventory, and that's discussed in his reply brief as well. And I just wanted to touch on that briefly because I thought it was important. They're trying to say that, you know, we've ordered all of these products, so of course we were ready. I went back and looked at the 7 invoices they described in their reply brief. But over half of those invoices contain notations on them, notations such as, quote, samples, quote, try to create products the powders could go into, including bars, popsicles, brownies, breads, used to make recipes. One says, sent powder to the chocolate dye. I don't know what that is. One of the invoices, which is located in the excerpts of record at page 918, is for 1,200 bottles of product on October 5th of 2009. But when you go and look at another document in the record at excerpts of record at 1618, it's a summary that the taxpayers prepared, a real food, real life chronology. And it identifies all 1,200 of those bottles as samples. These notations let you know that these products that they were getting weren't for sale. They were used in trying to develop the products. Mrs. Yap testified how awful some of these probiotic products tasted, and it was her goal to make these palatable so that kids and other people would be willing to buy them, to take them.
Ms. Moriarty, what if in the corporate papers it said that the corporate purpose was not just to sell these items, but its purpose was also to develop a formula for supplements, for example, or develop these foods? Isn't that what they're doing before 2011? They're developing the product, so shouldn't they be able to have ordinary necessary business expenses?
No, the law is very clear that when you're in the developmental stage, you don't get to develop the deduct the expenses. It's only once you've started into an ongoing business.
But what if you define your business in your corporate papers as developing them in addition to selling them? That doesn't matter to under the tax code?
Well, you have to have finished the development. Whether or not you've actually made a sale, as some of the cases point out, isn't the determining factor, but you can't still be in this development and research stage.
So a pharmaceutical company that's doing R&R cannot use the cost that R&R is as reasonable and necessary business expenses?
I think not until that product, whatever it is they're developing. I mean, I don't really know how a pharmaceutical company set up it. But in this case, they were working with Real Food Real Life was working to get a probiotic that was palatable that they could sell. And that didn't happen. It took them, as Mrs. Yap testified, years of research and trial and error. And it wasn't until 2011 that they felt that their product was ready to go.
What about Mr. Taylor's point that they did report some some receipts for 2009 and 2010? So maybe they weren't very successful and the sales were modest, but doesn't that suggest that they were selling something in those years?
It's not clear what the one year it was $200 and the other year was $3,194. It's not clear what that was, but that would just be one factor that the tax court was looking at here. Tax court didn't mention that specifically, I don't believe, but it when you're looking at trying to determine when this company started as a going concern, there are multiple facts that courts look to. And so in this case, the tax court laid out about 8 or 10 that it believed showed that Real Food Real Life began in 2011. Whether or not there were minimal sales earlier than that doesn't automatically show that it was operating as a going concern earlier than that.
Counsel, going back for a minute to Judge Murphy's question, there would likely be a difference in the tax approach to a pharmaceutical company that was actively selling 50 products and was doing R&D on product number 51, as opposed to one that was doing R&D on its first product and hadn't sold anything, right?
Correct. But I still think that a pharmaceutical company needs to, you know, if they have 1,000 products that they're selling and when they're trying to develop that next product, that the cost involved in that still are considered research and development costs, and they would be covered by 195, not by Section 162.
Okay.
I also think it's worth noting that to the extent that they're claiming that they started maybe even in 2008, but certainly by 2009, and we're looking at all the inventory they ordered in that year, when you look at their tax returns, the Schedule C, which is the profit and loss for the businesses, there's a line on that form. It's box H. And it says, if you started or acquired this business for 2009, it said 2009, for 2010, it said 2010, it says check here. And for 2009, there's no check in that box, but there is a check in the box on the 2010 return, indicating that when taxpayers filed their returns in 2010, they believe they started in that year and not earlier. Of course, it's the commissioner's position here that Real Food Real Life began at the earliest in 2011 based on all the factors that we argued below and that the tax court used in its opinion for holding that the business hadn't started yet. And I think all of those factual determinations are very persuasive that they were still in the developmental stage trying to figure out what the best product was that they could sell.
I'm sorry, did you say the box H on Schedule C for the 2010 return is checked?
It is checked.
And wait, what? Because I have a copy of that on 461 of the ER.
Page 463 of the ER.
463. I see. Okay.
It's line H.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Yes, okay. Let's see. I guess the penalty, the accuracy penalty, I would like to point out that in the tax court below, prior to the opinion coming out, when you go back and look at taxpayers' opening and answering briefs, the only reason they argued that they weren't liable for the penalty was because they relied on a CPA,
and that's why that's what the tax court discussed in the opinion. Yes,
correct. And so it wasn't until they filed their motion for reconsideration that they brought up this reasonably debatable argument that they have. And so, I guess my first point would be that it's not a proper place when you're dealing with motions for reconsideration. You can't raise a new argument that you hadn't raised below. And
counsel, did you argue waiver in your answering brief?
I don't think I did. No,
I don't think you did either.
Okay. Well, then the next reason was to the extent that they're claiming that these startup costs, it's reasonably debatable, and therefore the penalty shouldn't apply. They're just wrong. The law has been settled for decades as to when a taxpayer is engaged in a trade or business or when they begin to function as a going concern. The legal standard to determine when a business commenced is clear, and the only question here was whether Real Food Real Life met that standard. Taxpayers' arguments in the tax court in finding that they didn't start operating as a business do not implicate any unsettled legal issue or involve a question of first impression. The alleged novelty of the facts in this case don't negate the fact that the underlying tax principles involved are well settled, and therefore they didn't have a reasonably debatable position that justifies abatement of the penalties. Would the court like me to discuss the standard of review or the wages issue, which I think are pretty well covered in our brief?
I don't have a question on the wages issue, but why don't you discuss the standard of review in your view on the startup issue?
Okay. To me, it seems that particularly with the, both the Real Food, Real Life business expenses and, of course, the wages expenses, they're both factual questions. The Sixth Circuit case we cited in our brief, Braz versus Commissioner, was exactly involving when a taxpayer is carrying on a trade or business, and it found that the standard of review was for clear error. I also would note that cited by the tax court and in our brief was the case of Koenig versus Commissioner, a case that I personally handled over 20 years ago. And although it's in an unpublished opinion, this court too held that the standard of review there was clearly erroneous for when an individual was starting his artifact business. But
why does that make sense? I mean, obviously that there are some findings of, you know, historical fact, like, you know, what was the date of the first sale? You know, what did the trademark application say or not say? And, you know, those are all are facts. But it seems like the ultimate conclusion of, you know, at what point does this, you know, collection of historical fact add up to something that will be deemed a going concern seems to be sort of bound up with a legal question. So why isn't that at least a mixed question of law or fact?
Well, I think that even if you wanted to view it as a mixed question of law or fact, as the Jackson case cited by taxpayers do, the Jackson case relied on another 10th Circuit case called Lovebox. And that Lovebox case relied on a 9th Circuit case, United States versus McConney, which is at 728 Fed Second 1195. It's a 1984 case. And it discussed when you're looking at a mixed question, if the issue tends to be more factually based and concerns factors more appropriate decided by a trial court, then you look to the clearly erroneous standard. So the court took a functional approach there. And I would say that that's what applies here, because you have to look at any number of facts to determine what it was these taxpayers were doing in terms of trying to get their business off the ground. And you know, with each different type of business, those factors are going to change, but that's going to be a factual question, particularly where the law has been settled here for 50 years. If you go back to the very good opinion from the Fourth Circuit in Richmond Television, I believe it's called, detailing when a business starts. And so then you're just looking to the facts of each individual case, and that is why you would apply a clearly erroneous standard, even if you were going to look toward a mixed question. This court seems to indicate that you apply this functional approach. So are there any other further questions?
No.
Okay, then we'd ask that the tax court opinion be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Mr. Taylor?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to address, Judge Bennett, your comment that about when you have a pharmaceutical company doing more than one thing. That's what happened here. There was a contract. This is the contract at 866 of the excerpts of record. They were doing two things. They were importing AGM product directly and selling it, and they were developing their own product. They did not receive their own developed product until July of 2009, but they were selling AGM. That was clearly, had to have been their first sale of $200 or so in 2009. That's enough to get them in the door. Okay? There are two things going on here. Just read the contract. So we're not limited to that. So from our standpoint, there are multiple things. Two, check the box on 2010. I'm aware of that. There's a reason why we're not arguing reliance on the CPA. Checking the box is one of them. However, we'll take 2010 if the court doesn't, this court doesn't believe that this was sufficient in 2009. We'll take 2010. There's absolutely no reason why the court can't, if it believes it started in 2010 but not 2009, can reverse the tax court as to that. The testimony at the trial level was that the apps didn't review the return. They obviously did not see that the box was checked, and obviously a CPA who checks a bot who prepares the 09 and 10 return to Schedule C's for the same business and says that I'm checking the box for 2007 didn't do something right. We understand that.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments. This case is submitted, and with that, we are adjourned for the day.
Thank you.